Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to our first great experiment. We have Inside College Soccer live. So right now we're being joined. I've got Reese Canella. I've got Andre Luciano. We got Chris Cousins in the background helping us. He's our producer today. And we're being joined by a few folks. So if you're listening to this on the live stream, you should be able to go to the link. You can click in. You can join us on Zoom. You can ask live questions. Yeah, how fun. We've got people joining us in. Hey, Andre, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Good. Thanks for joining us today. Hey, Reese.
Hey, what's up? How are we doing?
Good. And it's good. Midnight for Chris back in England, so we won't make him talk. He's got to be exhausted. The end of a long day. So here's the idea, folks. We're going to open up by talking a little bit about currently what we as college coaches went through in the recruiting process and what we would have been doing at our schools in the recruiting process at this moment in time. So Andre, why don't you real quickly give us your background just so people know where you're coming from when we talk about where you would be in the recruiting process right now. If you were still coaching in college, here we are, October 6th, you're 6 weeks into your 12-week season, 10-week season, you're 5-6 weeks into it. Where would you be recruiting right now? What's your background?
Okay, so my background, I spent 25 years working in Division I women's soccer. I was an assistant coach at Arizona, Washington State, and Utah State. And I spent 18 years at a mid-major in the Big Sky Conference, Northern Arizona University. So, you know, I think for me, the biggest thing was, you know, our evaluation process, maybe it was a little bit different than some of the Power Five conferences. And we took a little bit of a longer time frame trying to evaluate players and commit players. And so for us, we probably would have been really working our 2023 class. You know, we'd have brought our 2023 class in for their official visits right now and really would have started spending a little bit more time getting to know our 2024, not actively trying to get a commitment from them, but trying to get to know them, have them understand the program. A lot of our 24s would have probably been coming in for official, unofficial visits, you know, where they paid their own way to come in. But a lot has changed in the last couple of years with the new rules. And so, you know, our ability to contact and have on-campus evaluations in Division I, you know, it used to be open where if a kid came in on an unofficial visit at any point in time, we could see him. But the NCAA rules changed. And, you know, I think kids had to wait now until June 15th to get that that evaluation. But right now, mostly probably focused on our team and at this point, because this would be the beginning of conference. And then try to make sure that we secured our 2023s and got ready for signing date in November.
In a typical year, where would you have been at with your 2023s at Northern Arizona right now? Would they all be identified? Would you still be looking for a few key players? What percentage of your roster do you think would be identified?
I would say probably about 65 to 70% of our roster
would be identified by this time.
Yeah, for sure. In terms of our incoming class, just because of our camps and how much time we had spent during the year. But we would have always been open to finding new players if a new player popped up.
Sure.
And we didn't have the transfer portal, you know, so that was still not in existence when I was still coaching there.
Yeah. We're going to talk about the transfer portal in a little bit. We just were also joined by Joe Flanagan. So let me get to Reese real quick. And then Joe, I'm going to come around to you and then I'll chime in real quick. Hey, Reese.
Hey.
So what's your background? Where were you coaching at?
Yeah, so I played in Ohio at Tiffin University. And so that led me to a grad assistantship at Urbana University, D2 program. And then I had stints at D3 and D2 programs, Ashland University, Walsh University, just got placed in top 25. And then my last stint before moving into this role of SRUSA was with Baldwin-Wallace University, which is just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, right next to Cleveland Airport, if anyone's ever been there. And that was Division III, Ohio Athletic Conference. And so for me, being in and around Ohio, in and around the Midwest, was an area that I was, familiar with and used to having played there and coached there. So for my last stint at Baldwin-Wallace University, say right now, we'd be in a similar position to what Andre said, where we've identified, 60, 70% of our 23 class. We would have had a camp or two in the summer trying to identify players. And then high school season runs concurrently to the college season in Ohio. So we would be playing our games and then we would be trying to identify players in the Cleveland area at their high school games if we could kind of get away from practice, or if we had a short practice, maybe practice finished at 6:30 and we're rushing off to the high school trying to get to their games. So we're trying to identify players there. I'd say at this point we would have a commitment or two, not much more than that, but we may have a commitment. We're trying to bring players on campus at this point. It's a very busy time. So on non-game days, we're trying to bring players on campus so that they can get the campus feel, meet our players, maybe have lunch with the players, meet professors and really get an idea of what campus is like, especially, in the fall when, I think campuses around the country are excited. There's a buzz around campus, usually good weather for most places. You've got, teams who are doing well and some who are maybe, not as well, but they're going into conference. So they're looking forward to that. So, for us, it's a time to get players on campus and really try to get players, up on the whiteboard and see who you're identifying and see who, is committing elsewhere or who's interested in you, and trying to really get that next class together and hoping that within the next 6 months that you've got a good class to come in and really help you compete.
Yeah, I coached at Division III for 5 years, 6 years. And it was, we always complained that we felt like we were, like even junior colleges were ahead of us. We always felt like we were the last choice that players wanted to go to. And that's just the way, personally, the way that we felt, because we couldn't even give them a book scholarship. Give them anything.
It's an interesting division.
Come in, so I understand. Yeah, and it's different. Northeast than it is in other parts of the country. It depends on the academic level, rankings, national rankings of the school, and things like that. So it's a very division. Hey, so Joe, why don't you give us your background and tell us where you think you would have been, I suppose, especially Dominguez Hills.
I was at Dominguez Hills for 24 years as a head coach. And honestly, our recruiting calendar kind of changed a lot during that time. In the beginning, it was just identification and casting a wide net. And we even cast a wide net towards the end too, because we wanted to make sure if kids that we identified that were maybe Division I kind of quality kids, but maybe fell through the cracks, we want to keep our eye on them and then identify some kids that maybe were ready to sign with us, or commit to us in the fall. So we would have some guys identified in the fall, bring them out to some of our fall games, especially some of the big games. We used to get one game a year in the main stadium with the Galaxy. So that was kind of a big recruiting tool for us. So we would do that. And And then, you know, obviously once the fall season over, it was really into high gear. And again, towards probably the last 4 or 5 years, we probably had 3 or 4 guys committed in the fall. But it wasn't until my last year on signing date in the first week of November or first week of February, because we didn't have the early sign date back then. But we had 10 guys signed on signing day in 2018. And that was the first time I'd ever had like a class, you know, signed and sealed and delivered on signing day. We were regularly getting guys, you know, committed in March and April. That was, I mean, we hardly ever had our, you know, bunch of letter of intents going out in early February. So we were always waiting around, casting a big net, and then ready to pounce when we could and really try to bring the top guys. And, you know, I did coach the girls for a while too at Dominguez, and that was obviously it worked out pretty well when you're coaching both teams, because the girls did actually were able to commit a little earlier because Division I's committed a little earlier, and then we were able to commit girls a little earlier. So we were able to focus on the girls side a little bit earlier and then really get to the guys, you know, around that, you know, fall, winter time. Right. So yeah, I mean, I think at Division I, I always feel like, you know, you can identify your players and hopefully, you know, the bigger schools, they can identify them and grab them. And to me, Division II, we took a different approach. We cast a wider net. And I used to laugh at Division II coaches when we were in the fall season and they would say that they're done recruiting. I was like, oh, good, because I'm going to grab a couple good players when you're not watching. So I always left that door open. Because they're, you know, especially in Southern California and obviously other parts of United States, there's a lot of good players and there are a lot of players that can fall through the cracks. And I think that's where, you know, obviously, you know, it's like, you know, at SRUSA, I think we can help out and get those players identified into the right place.
Yeah. And I coached in the same conference. That's where Joe and I first met. He was doing the women at Dominguez Hills and I was at Cal State East Bay. And, we were probably about halfway through right now. We were still bringing kids onto campus. We were still trying to close it out. And as Joe said, we learned early on as a staff to hold out spots available for D1 kickbacks. Kids that maybe were from the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and had gone away to school Division I and it didn't work out well. And they were coming back. So the transfer portal didn't exist, but the soccer community is a small community. And we ended up getting some fantastic Division I kickbacks in March, late. So we always held out open a few spots, but we were probably halfway through, about half our money had been given out. So we still had some scholarship money. Although out in California, people think that rich state must have a lot of scholarships. The CCAA is not a wealthy conference. Not a single team, at least when I was coaching there for my 12 years, was in had 9.9 scholarships on the girls' side or 9 on the guys' side. So, okay, let's get to some questions, guys. We're gonna open up here with the most common question we get by far. We're about to start the college recruiting journey with my child. What's the first thing I should do? Joe, go.
Obviously, academics is a big thing and that keeps a lot of doors open. So I've learned that as a coach and I've learned that as a parent. So academics to me is obviously got to stay the focus. And then from there, you know, playing at a high, the highest caliber you can play at, you know, whether that's ECNL or MLS Next or whatever we're talking about, whether it's NPL maybe. But the other thing too, is I do think that there's such a focus on college now that everybody starts talking about college maybe way a little too early, and the player needs to focus on getting better. And I feel like sometimes that's being lost a little bit in the message. And the college side, hopefully between parents and coaches and maybe, you know, people like us, the college side will get there. But when they're eighth, ninth grade or something, and they're talking about college all the time. It's like, hey, let's focus on the controllables here, and the controllables are getting better and continue to grow as a player.
Yeah, and I know we have, I mean, I always, and I've said this online, even if freshman year is too young, and I know I've been slammed for, well, you guys have five freshman clients. How can you say they're too? Yeah, but those kids don't want to worry about the college process. That's why they come to us, so that they can focus on just getting better, knowing we'll take care of it for them. It's not, because we tell freshman parents there's not a lot to do. Make sure your kids are getting good grades. We want to kind of monitor where they're playing. We can now watch them in person 2-3 years in a row, 5-6 times each year. So you're right. I think people worry a little bit too early about trying to go into the whole college process. Like, should I go to ID camps in 8th grade and 9th grade? And yeah, just focus on getting better, right? What do you think, Andre? Do you have anything to add to that, or do you disagree? Yeah. Or
you know, I've stepped away from the last, I've been gone since the end of the 2018 season, and I went back for a year to coach at the junior college where I played. This is how I would approach it, is as a family, sit down and figure out what is your budget for college? I think that's huge. I think to have a serious sit down and say, what have we planned for this in terms of college? What happens if you no longer want to play, and have a realistic budget, which is going to set the tone basically for what you can look at. I think people have this misconception that, you know, we are like football, basketball, or volleyball, where everybody gets a full scholarship on, especially on the women's side. It's not, you know, you have 14 scholarships in Division I on the women's side, 9.9 on the men's side, 9 scholarships in Division II, and, you know, I think what, 12 in NAIA, right, on the men's side. And then, you know, Division III, there are no scholarships. Even in junior colleges, they're different. There's Division I, II, and III in junior colleges, which varies your ability to get money out. And so I always talk about, you know, figure out what your budget is, figure out academically where it's a good fit, figure out where location is. And honestly, soccer is a piece that ties it all together, because, you know, you can't predict anything. Like, if there's a situation like my family, you know, my family had a hardship in terms of finances when my dad lost his job, and we had to claim bankruptcy. And that changed my whole aspect of what I was going to do for college. And my parents basically said, we can't pay for college. You've got to figure this out on your own. And so that changed my own personal path. But I also know there's some kids that, you know, go through some things, and, you know, maybe they have a terrible semester in school, and all of a sudden that kid that had the perfect 4.0 now has a 3.5, and it might completely affect their academic trajectory of where they thought they were going to go. And so I think you have to have a little bit of a perspective in terms of what it is, and, you know, and understand that a lot of kids have invested so much on the youth side, and sometimes they just get to college and they're just burned out and they just don't want to play anymore. And I think if you, you know, the number one stressor I think that kids go through, and they really don't talk about it, is the finance aspect of it. And so if you know you can afford the school, you're in the right place, it has the academics and the majors that you want, I think the soccer becomes a little bit more of a enjoyable experience than always being under stress in terms of having to produce, having to perform. You can kind of handle things a little bit more. So I think my approach is a little bit different when I talk to the clients that we work with. I kind of put a little bit more of a holistic approach to this, and a little bit more of an open-ended conversation, like an open conversation in terms of, like, what's your values as a person? What's your values as a family? What is it that you want out of your experience? And then let's figure out, how do you get there? And what do you, you know, maybe I can help you open up your eyes in terms of what the possibilities are.
Yeah, I always liked it. My brain works backwards. So, like, what's the end goal? What are you trying to accomplish? And then what are the steps that you need to get there? And I think the college process has, it can be thought of a lot that way too.
And also, because I ask players, I'm like, what do you want to do? And they're telling me, like, hey, I want to go to law, or I want to go to med school. I'm like, well, you know, you're looking at a 6-7 year process, not a 4-year process. So,
yes,
thinking, you know, this isn't just a short-term 4-year thing. This is a 7-year process for you if you're looking to go into, you know, med school. And there's a lot of different things. And I think sometimes, you know, the club coaches don't really ask those questions. And so to have somebody that can, like a mentor or an advisor or somebody that can help them it asks a lot of questions that maybe don't even think about.
Yeah, I agree. Boy, this next question here, I love it. I'm glad somebody asked it. And because I've gotten slammed for this one too on social media. Do you have to play ECNL, GA, MLS Next to get recruited? Is it mandatory? What I always say is, look, it greases the skids, no doubt. You're going to, when you go to these national events, I've been to PDA, I've been to SoCal, the GA, I've been to MLS Next Fest, I've been to a lot of these events, and there's a lot of coaches there. There's more coaches going to these events than any other events in the country. They can see what they feel is more quality talent in one place and don't have to go to what we used to have to go to 4 or 5 tournaments to see the same amount of talent. They can see it in one place. So my answer is it greases the skids. I mean, it definitely makes it easier. The question is, do you have to play? The answer is no. But if you don't, I think you have to figure out another way for coaches to pay attention to you. Now, one of the things that we're worried about as college coaches is when a player comes to us as a freshman to come play for us, they're going to have to compete against 19, 20, 21, 22, sometimes 23, 24-year-olds. And we need to know that they are capable of playing at the highest levels against the best players. I think the problems that I see with ECNL, with any of these, I don't want to pick on any one of them, whether GA, ECNL, MLS Next, is that there are the elite 10% teams, and then there's a whole lot of kind of the same, a lot of mediocrity, and then there's a few at the bottom that are really bad. And they're all playing under the same level. It's no different in my mind than Division I. Division I women's soccer, I say, has striated into at least 9 different levels, from really good to really bad. And these striations of levels in between of we're always in the hunt for a national title. We get in the hunt for a national title every 15 years. We're in the hunt. We always win our conference title and we lose in the first or second round of the national championships. We're praying to make the conference tournament. We've never made the conference tournament, but we hope to make it someday. We're some of the worst schools in the country. We're not very good. We get beat by junior colleges in the spring. And that's all under Division I. And I noticed ECNL, GA, MLS Next, NPL, name the league, it doesn't matter, is the same way. And I think that there's this misconception that if you play in these leagues, it's automatic. You're going through. What do you think about that, Reese?
I think the short answer is no. But to elaborate on that, you know, we was down at San Diego at the GA tournament down there, me and you, Don. And, you know, there's players playing and there's a lot of coaches, like we said, and, you know, we're rubbing shoulders and talking to these coaches. And I actually went to watch one of our consultants' players, and the players, you know, who was playing, and then in their game, all the coaches were looking at another team, the other two teams that were on another field. So, you know, that player and that team, they weren't really being watched in that moment. Now, maybe they were watched later on in the tournament on a different day. But, you know, that just sort of adds to my point in that, no, you don't have to be in one of those leagues, because, you know, you may be in one of those leagues and be at the tournament and not get watched. So it's not a guarantee. Now, what I will say is that coaches and their staff, they don't have the resources and the time, especially the time, I would say, to be going to all these other leagues. So it seems like ECNL and GA on the women's side, and then MLS Next and ECNL on the boys' side seem to be the go-to leagues for the coaches. And that's because, again, with their lack of time and lack of resources, right now they're in season, right? And then they have to go out there. And then with the leagues competing against each other, like I said to you, Don, like going back when we was at the GA in July, there was ECNL playoffs going on in Seattle. So if you was on Twitter and you're looking at where coaches are going, coaches were at Seattle and then they were going down to San Diego or vice versa, or their staff split in half. I spoke to a D1 coach in the Big Ten, and they had coaches up in the Midwest, and they had coaches down at MLS Next in, I want to say Frisco, Texas. And then they had, because it was the same weekend as the GA, they had coaches at ECNL for the boys in San Diego. And so, you know, coaches, they have to try and hit these different leagues. But, you know, if they can kind of go back and lean on one or two, then they're probably going to go with, you know, your MLS Next, your GA, your ECNL. However, you know, we just committed a player to Indiana. He did not play for an MLS Next team or ECNL team. And so that says it right there. I have another player who's freshman, been very successful at Rollins College. And he has started, he came in as a freshman, and it was, I think it was a perfect level for him because he didn't start, but now he's earned his spot. And now as a freshman, he's playing and getting valuable minutes. He didn't play in one of those leagues. And so I say the short answer is no, but there's a lot to it. And so ultimately, I think the player has to be happy in their environment and has to trust that the coaches are going to help them to improve. And then I think with that, you know, the player should find a college that suits them. But, you know, those leagues are popular leagues, and they definitely send a lot of players to college.
Yeah, and Andre, there's a perception that we're, that SRUSA is against ECNL because we don't want the players playing there, with this nefarious idea that if they don't play in those leagues, they won't get noticed, and then they'll have to come to us for help. What do you say to that?
I mean, this is what I'm going to say. If I was a 17-year-old or 16-year-old right now, I knew what my financial situation was as a player with my family, I would have never gone to college and got recruited. And that's because I wouldn't have been able to afford a platform and what it required me to do. And by my senior college, I was I was considered an elite player playing at Indiana. And I was a national player of the year in junior college, but I never would have gone to college. I would have never played. And so I think that, no, you don't need a platform. What I always was concerned with as a college coach is I always wanted to recruit winners. And I always wanted to recruit impact players. And so if I would go to an event and I'd watch a team consistently get beat over and over and over again, and I didn't feel like those kids that were on the field were going to be impact players. Otherwise, they would be making an impact in the game and helping their teams win. And that would translate to college. And on the flip side of that, I would go to some, I had a team in Arizona called the Ladybugs. This is, and everybody made fun of that team because of their name, but they won six state titles in a row, high school state titles in a row. No, excuse me, club championships, like state cup. And that group of players that I recruited from that team that nobody else wanted, helped us win three conference titles and NCAA appearances. And, but those teams, those kids knew how to win. And so when they came onto our team, they knew how to win. And then the other thing too is, why would I want to recruit the number 15, 16, 17, 18 player on a roster thinking that they're going to come in and be a Division I college high impact player? It wasn't going to happen. And so I wanted to find players that were impact players. I wanted to find players that knew how to win, and that had a little bit of a chip on their shoulder and had a struggle and fight and battle. That fit my personality and my personality type. So if a kid can do GA, if a kid can do ECNL, you know, if they can afford that and that's what they want to do, it's fine. But like, you know, I look at my club kids and, you know, I put a $10,000 sticker price on club travel. I've got families that are balking, you know, they're like, we can't afford that. I put a $6,000 or $7,000 price tag and they're like, I can't afford that. And so I think it doesn't bode well for the long-term growth of soccer in this country. And if we only say, hey, these are the only platforms that you can grow out of. And I think Steve Sampson, when he, and Joe, you might remember this, when Steve Sampson came in and did a thing where he said, hey, ODP, you guys are not evaluating players correctly. I don't feel I've got some scouts out. Let's put a group of players that we evaluate and put them in the regional championships. It was in Bakersfield, because that's when I got a heat stroke. And those kids, those teams won almost every single age division. And these are kids that were not playing for elite clubs. They were just good soccer players, and they did a really good job in the evaluation process and identification process of these players. And so I don't know. I just think that there's something for everybody, and you can't say that this is the best and this is the only way to get seen. There's different ways in all aspects of it.
All right, Big Joe, what do you think? So you're in the Mecca, right? You're in Southern California. You've got a son committed to where? Notre Dame, right?
Yeah.
You got a daughter who's playing at
Western Michigan? Yeah.
And you've been involved. I mean, this is it. This is where people have looked to some of the best teams and best players for a long time. What's your take on this?
Well, I'll expand a little bit on what Andre said too. It's like, I think that first of all, there's been so many changes in youth soccer over the last, 5 to 8 years. And a lot of players have been lost in the shuffle because of that. And I think that hopefully soccer can settle down and we can go with MLS Next and ECNL, and we can kind of follow suit from there. Because I do think that players are getting lost, and that's not good for soccer. But one of the other things too, like with, especially when academy was around and stuff, I felt like the word development was overused. Everything was about development, and the word competition was hardly ever used. And I feel that from the coach standpoint, and now, me being a dad, being competitive is a part of development. It's not either or. You can't just be competitive and not develop. I mean, to me, competing and trying to win, trying to figure out a way to win is important. You can't just let the game be the game and whatever happens, happens. Players need to figure things out. And one of the best things I heard, one of my players told it to me, his dad was a Brazilian guy. And he said, the game is like a puzzle, and that puzzle is going to be different every game. I mean, you got to figure out how to solve that puzzle. And I think that's true. And sometimes I feel like players nowadays, and sometimes in ECNL or MLS Next, they show up, they play, but they're not figuring out a way to win. So I do think just because you're playing at the highest level doesn't mean you're getting better unless you're really challenging yourself and challenging your teammates each and every time you step on the field. So I think there is still kids, players that are getting, lost in the shuffle between different leagues and the different stuff that's happened. And I think that's hopefully, again, when the dust settles here, that soccer is going to get on a, not a pyramid, but like a place where coaches can know where to find players. Players know where to go to be at the highest level they can play at. And again, the other side of it too is that, a lot of people tell me about when I was a player that I was a late bloomer, that, I really bloomed in college. So that happens too. You could be a, a decent player in high school and club, and all of a sudden you get to college and things start to click and you become a better player because you found the right environment. And I think environment is key, at the youth level, at the college level, environment is very important in terms of your overall development. And I mean, I coached at the NAI level my last 3-4 years, and I found some local domestic kids, and we, got to the final round of the NAI, and people are asking me, how are you being so successful with all these domestic players? And I was like, well, this is what I do. I go out and find players that I feel like can make a difference. And I do think those players are there. So I think it's important for players to, keep with their goals, keep on working hard and hopefully they're in the right environment and we'll continue to grow as players and we'll be seen and get that right opportunity in college.
Yeah, I love it. So yeah, so anybody listening to this, look, we're not against any of these leagues. We're not. But I think people just have to know what they're getting when they get into it and do what's right for them. We have a question now about the COVID exemption year. So just to catch everybody up to speed, 2020 COVID hits, college soccer sort of happening, but not happening. And it was delayed and it was a mess. Some teams were playing 4, 5, 6 games. A lot of teams weren't able to play any. So they decided every organization, NJCAA, the NWAC, that's the junior colleges up north, the CCCAA out in California, junior colleges, Division III, Division II, Division I, NAIA, all decided anybody who played soccer this year, it doesn't count. It doesn't count for anybody. So that gave everybody an extra year sort of to play. 2020, and then 21 and 22 and 23 and 24, those classes all got affected. So the first clean class is class 2025. Completely miscalculated how many kids would stay. I figured after years 1, 2, 3, I figured kids would have 2, 3 years of normalcy. They'd get job offers. They'd go on to their jobs. But what's happened is our economy has taken a tank. It's a really tough time to step out of college and go to the workplace. Inflation is as high as it's been in a long time. Kids are deciding to stay in for an extra year. So I think it's a combination of the economy, kids wanting to get their master's degrees. We've got right now 4 or 5, I was looking today, master's degree candidates that are still have eligibility years that we have available as players. So I think this is going on in across the country. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm getting a lot of college coaches when we ask them, and we've talked to hundreds, not thousands of college coaches every year. And we ask them the question, what are you still looking for 23? What are your needs for 24? And we're getting a lot of uncertainty. Yeah, we don't know because we don't know which super seniors, which is what they've been labeled as, that are staying in for the fifth year. We don't know how many of those are going to stay. So we need to kind of wait. We don't know yet. Are you hearing the same thing, Andre?
Yeah, I think just even through my interactions with, you know, former colleagues and friends, and I'm asking them like, hey, what's going on? Or like, listen, there's a total logjam right now. We are waiting for our seniors to figure out if they're going to come back. We are trying to figure out, and they don't know until after the season how they feel. We are looking at the potential of having graduate students come in for a year out of the transfer portal. And so there's so many different variables that are happening right now. And, you know, I think sometimes coaches look at it and they're like, hey, if I take a chance on a 22-year-old that has already played a couple of years versus a 17-year-old coming out of high school that has not proven themselves yet in the collegiate stage, it's difficult, right? And so you almost have to kind of find the perfect fit. And you kind of have to be in the know of who's looking and who's not looking. You know, we just had a conversation yesterday, Don, you and I, with the same coach, and he was saying that, hey, you know, I've got 8. I just found out I'm going to have 8 seniors graduate. I just found out about it. So I'm going to have a need now for down the spine of my team. This is what my need is going to be. And it's really late. And so can you help me out? And so I think that's kind of what's going to happen a little bit. We're going to have a lot of kids now that are going to probably make those decisions that they don't want to play. Some other kids are going to figure out, hey, I could go to this school for a year and get school paid for a year and go get my master's at that school. So I'm going to leave my current institution, graduate, and then still have a year of eligibility and go to that school. And I think this was going to be the last year that really, that's 24 class, it's 23, 24 class. I think things are going to kind of clear up a little bit. The water, the stream is going to start flowing and we're going to have some clarity. I talk a lot about water being, you know, the water is going to start flowing a little bit clearer and it's not going to kind of get backed up because that's what's happening. We're kind of getting backwash, right? It's going forward and coming back. and the coaches, the water is really murky, and they can't look down and say, I can't even see my feet in this.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's not a bad way to describe it. I know Johns Hopkins has, I think they brought in 9 transfers and 5 of them are master's degree transfers. And we're just kind of seeing that kind of transfer thing going on across the country. Let's see, Joe, you and I were talking about the transfer portal earlier. And that's another question that's come up, is how has the transfer portal affected college recruiting?
Yeah, I think when we're talking about it, I feel like it could push timelines back a little bit more. Colleges might take a little more time to make that final decision on what player they're going to bring in, which again, I think that what Andre said is correct too. Like it's going to clear up here in the next year and a half. But right now these graduating seniors this year, I don't know if this is the right way to say it, but it's like, I do think some of those incoming freshmen maybe have to look at a long-term opportunity, not a right away opportunity. I feel like they might not start right away. You know, they might not play that first year or something like that, but if it's a good school, a good institution, a good program, checks all those boxes, but they're not going to play right away because of this transfer stuff. They brought in a graduate student or the transfer portal, whatever's going on. I feel like you don't want to go to some school just because you can play right away. And that's the only reason why you're going there. There's got to be more to that puzzle. There's got to be more to that equation to me. So more incoming players are dealing with that maybe scenario. And I feel like they have to be a little more patient than maybe they had to in the past. So I do think the transfer portal is affecting those incoming freshmen, and it might continue because I'm saying from my perspective as a college coach, I wouldn't want to rely on the transfer portal every year to bring in my top guys. I mean, that's not somewhere I'd want to be. And I'm hoping that college coaches don't use that. They might specialize it for a goalkeeper or a center back that they need like in a pinch, but hopefully their plan is to bring in guys, and they're bringing in guys for 3-4 years. And that to me is the successful way of building a good program, is you have to have players around you for 3-4 years to really get a good nucleus and really build from there. So I think that's the transfer portal can fix a couple problems, but it's not going to fix your program overall for a long term.
And it's interesting because I will tell you, and I think it's mostly younger coaches. There are coaches shopping the transfer portal, and that's where they're getting the majority of their recruiting class over the last couple of years. That is going on out there. But I agree with you. And I saw Andre, you shaking your head. Reese, you probably, I'm going to guess you agree with it. I don't know. What do you think? That, and the question on the table is, yeah, if you can build a relationship with your players for 2, 3, 4 years, I think you can get the most out of your players by doing that. What do you think, Reese?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think, you know, if you can bring a freshman in and they can kind of learn the ropes and you know, and understand the culture that you're trying to build, and, you know, they go into their sophomore year and junior year more comfortable, then kind of show the players, you know, how to navigate this college soccer you know, system, then, you know, I think that's great. And that's probably what you would, as a coach, like to do. I think the reality of it, some coaches are, you know, under pressure. They need to win. And so that's where they'll look to the transfer portal for a quick fix. You know, depending if that player has a year eligibility, or, you know, if they're an older player. So I think if you can get a good mix of, or, you know, more players who you've identified, young players you've identified, and you know, want them to come through your system essentially, and you know, and really lay the foundations, I think that's great. I definitely think there's room for transfer portal players as well, to where they might be able to bring, you know, the experience that, you know, your younger players might not have. And if they can get on board quickly, then I think you have a recipe for success. But, you know, there's coaches out there who, you know, they want to kind of build from the ground up, but then there's some that may feel under pressure, and they feel that they need to get players in that are going to help them instantly, and maybe don't have the time for the growing pains that you know, the underclassmen that might bring. So there's definitely a need for, you know, your transfer portal, but at the same time, players, you know, seniors coming up from high school.
And by the way, when Reese is talking about a coach under pressure, it's because we have limited contracts. We usually have 1, 2, 3, 4 for, we've been usually no more than 3 year contracts. And if their reviews didn't go well with their AD at the end of the year, and they know they must win more games, then the transfer portal can be used as a band-aid sometimes, and they can find some good value there. But the transfer portal, by the way, has two kinds of players. Those that did extremely well and are moving up, those that didn't get to play or didn't do so well, their value has dropped. Not very many players in the transfer portal just making horizontal transfers from one 500 school to one 500 school, both state schools, both similar academics. If that is happening, it's usually because the culture wasn't right for the player. But most of the transfer portal is players moving up or players moving down. And by the way, the transfer portal, just for so the public knows, include junior college or NAIA players. It's just Division III, Division II, Division I, just NCAA players. I wish there was a transfer portal that encompassed all of it.
And then the other thing too, Don, is the amount of kids that enter the transfer portal and never reappear.
60% on the guys' side, I did the math, or I saw an article actually, 60% on the guys' side and 40% on the girls' side didn't ever reappear somewhere else to play. So that's something to think about. No guarantees, right? Okay, I like this one. Can soccer get me into a university that I'm not academically qualified for? How much pull do coaches have with admissions? So all three of us are state school type coaches, but we do have some experience with friends and with players that we've placed in the Ivies, the little Ivies. We've been having a conversation with Claremont McKenna schools, Claremont Mudscript schools, Andre. So what do you say to that question? Into a university that academically I wouldn't otherwise be qualified for?
Well, I'm just going to speak out of personal experience because I can't speak for other schools or other coaches. There was a very clear message that was sent that you as a coach cannot call admissions. And anything that you do is considered tampering. So I took that as a, don't pick up the phone, don't call admissions. And that was that. And that's what I live by. And you had to get in on your own.
What about you, Joe?
Yeah, I think those days are kind of over where if you're not qualified academically, you can still get into a top, you know, academic school. I think if you're on a national team type player level, maybe they have one spot that they can kind of really push the envelope there as a coach. But I, same as Andre, I was as a coach, I was never able to contact admissions myself. But we would able to maybe get one guy in or something, try to that. And then he would have to, you know, do some stuff through study hall and all that other stuff. But those days are kind of over, I think. And with, you know, obviously when the eligibility center came in, that changed things. It made it more of a, who was eligible, who wasn't. Right away it was a NCAA thing, not necessarily a school thing. And you know, sometimes you're setting those kids up to fail too. If you're pushing some kid into some school that he's not academically prepared for, is he going to succeed there anyways? So you kind of, again, you got that right fit. And those, again, the most college coaches don't have the pull that they maybe did 20 years ago.
Right. And I've been told that like back east at some of the higher end academic schools that coaches will get one or two exceptions, but it's really close. The way that one of the coaches described it to me says, look, if most of the kids that come in here are 4.0s and I have a kid that's at 3.85 and the kid's a dynamite player and everything lines up, I can get an exception or two, but they better be really close. Or SATs, you know, if our minimum requirement is a 1500 and I get a kid that's a 1210, no way. But if the kid's a 1480, then they'll let me talk to them. So it's still got to be within guidelines. So generally, you're right, Joe and Andre. I think in general, the idea that a 2.0 kid could end up at Stanford playing football is probably not happening. I think the UCLA scandal also put something, you know, put that all in the limelight, that, you know, kids that couldn't qualify to get into the school unless they were part of a sport, they were able to get in. I know I had a discussion with the UCLA men's coach right after that about a player, and we were looking at the grades, and he says, just probably not going to happen. So let's see. We have, all right, this will talk money. So what's a good amount of money for an athletic scholarship? Here's an example that this parent gave. A college costs about $62,000. You're getting $25,000 in academic money. So what's considered a good athletic scholarship? So this just gives us the opportunity, Andre and Joe, for us to talk about how college coaches think about spending their money. And what are the odds that a freshman gets money? How does that work? You want to start us out on that, Andre?
Yeah, because I'm going to have to head out here soon. So, well, listen, I was at a Division I school. We were fully funded. We had 14 scholarships. That doesn't mean that every school is going to be fully funded. Some schools have 7, some schools have 9, some schools might have 12, some schools might have 5 on the women's side. So I had 14 scholarships. The way I looked at it, probably, you know, I was banking on 3.5 scholarships per year to use, which would be what the natural allocation would be for our roster. Depending on who the athletic director was, they would say sometimes, hey, we just want you to carry a roster of 28. And then I've had situations where an AD has asked me, hey, I need you to carry 40 this year. And so it varies year to year, right? But you have in-state for the state schools. You have in-state, out-of-state tuition that you go by, and it all works for me. It worked on percentages. Some schools just strictly work on just dollar value. Private schools, it's a flat tuition rate, regardless if you're in-state, out-of-state. So it's a little bit different. But for an in-state school, like a good quality in-state kid that had a 3.5 GPA without any Cs, at my school, they would get tuition for free. And so that right there accounted for 37% of a, actually 47% of a full scholarship as an in-state student. And so then I would look to tack on maybe 40% for that player. And so then they would be sitting at an 87% scholarship, which is a pretty decent chunk of change. An out-of-state kid would cost me 67% for tuition. And so if the kid was a really good player, we'd offer him probably tuition and maybe room, which would put him at probably 79 or 80% of a full scholarship. Now, I would look for, traditionally, I would look for first and foremost, what would they qualify for academically in terms of what kind of money they would get academically, which would help us out a ton. And then I would look at what can I do for this year based on our needs. And it varies year to year. And sometimes I had to have a high priority player and I would offer, you know, I think I've only offered in 18 years, I only offered 4 full scholarships in 18 years. And then the rest were pretty much at a, maybe like at a 40 to 67 to 70% scholarship was depending if they're in state, out of state. So, it just varied, but you know, it also, that's why I said budget is always a big thing. If you come into this process, knowing what your actual financial budget is as a family, and you know that the cost of school is going to be, you know, $39,000 for full cost of attendance, and you're getting $25,000, and you know that your budget is maybe $15,000, then you're sitting in a pretty good spot. And if you get, you know, $8,000 or $9,000 scholarship, that's a, you know, doing the math, you're getting about a $36,000 back from what you initially thought you were going to spend. I don't know if that makes sense, but
yeah, no, just, it makes sense. It makes sense. So, Joe, we're starting to roll a little short on time, but take 60 seconds for me. See if you can answer that same question. How would you approach that? What do you think? How does a parent determine whether it's a good scholarship offer athletically or not?
I mean, for me, again, from the state's side of school, it was like, if we got tuition covered and then a little bit of money, books or some expenses, that's where we were at, because we at Dominguez Hills, we had like basically two scholarships. When I was winning a couple of championships, we literally had two scholarships. So we had to spend our money, our athletic money, very well. So I think if you're in the 60 to 70% of overall cost, I think that's a pretty good scholarship to me. You know, if you get above that, that's probably the better players are getting. And I think that's a good kind of, you know, when you got the whole package of academics, athletics, it gets kind of, sometimes players want to feel the value of getting more athletic money, but you have to look at the whole package. And if you get a good academic package and then you get some athletic money on top of that, and you get yourself to about 60, 70%, it's a pretty, pretty good scholarship, I think. And I think that's probably the norm of what players are going to get, going to receive.
Right. Yeah. I think we experienced the same thing in East Bay. Look, we had a kid on $5,000 athletic money. That was a ton of money for us. That was a top, top player, immediate impact. The last one I remember signing was Zuli Diaz, and she was two times all conference as a center back, two times all conference as a striker. And she was on probably one of the highest scholarships we ever gave out. But other than that, it was really tough. That's listening. We're going to come back next Thursday. We'll come back next Thursday. We'll do the same thing. We've got a lot of you that didn't get your questions answered. We'll make sure that we come back, circle around, get to those questions. So thanks for joining us from all of our staff at Sports Recruiting USA. If you have questions, you can reach out to us at info@srusasoccer.com. Go to our website. You can apply there if you're interested in becoming a client. We are an invitation-only agency, but we are taking applications. So we'll look forward to seeing you all next week live on Inside College Soccer. Thank you, everybody.